Hi, so the title of our paper is Investigating the Computer Security Needs and Practices of Journalists. And my name is Susan McGregor. I'm from Columbia Journalism School. This is work that I did with my co-author, Francesca Rosner, from the University of Washington, and Polina Charters and Tobin Holliday, who are part of the HCI and Design program, also at the University of Washington. So to talk a little bit about the motivation for this work, last year at Black Hat Asia, Shane Huntley and Morgan Marquis-Boire did a presentation about the fact that 21 out of the 25 top news sites in the world were subject to state-level attacks. And this is something that was already kind of known in the media. The previous year, news agencies had reported themselves that they had been the subject of attacks. The Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, Bloomberg, New York Times. And in a couple of those cases, the New York Times and the Bloomberg in particular, it was surmised that the motivation for these attacks was actually to discover the sources for stories. This was particularly in respect to China. Of course, we also know that the impetus to discover sources is not exclusive to these kinds of attacks. On the domestic front, metadata and kind of legal attacks have been used quite extensively in recent years to identify journalist sources. This was very much the case of James Risen at the New York Times and others. So there are a range of kind of computer security issues that journalists and journalistic organizations face in trying to conduct their work. And there are, in fact, quite a number of robust technical tools that help address these issues individually, right? So we have things like GPG that can provide, you know, static encryption, Tor, SecureDrop, which was actually designed specifically for journalism for kind of the document dead drop case. And yet, recent research, this was a Pew survey done with specifically investigative reporters globally that was released in February, found that a full 50% of them used no computer security tools whatsoever in conducting their work. Another 30% used one or two, but not with great regularity. And so the real question is, why not? It's clear that journalists are targets, that there are a wide range of kind of threat vectors that they face. There are tools that can help address some of these things, and yet for some reason, they're not doing anything about it. And so our observation was that maybe there's something, or understanding that there's something about the journalistic process that makes it difficult for journalists to effectively apply these tools in the way that they need to in order to conduct their work more securely. So also drawing from that Pew Research survey, this is a quote from a respondent saying, "I report on unauthorized immigrants a great deal and have concerns about how to communicate with them without putting them at risk. You know, many of them are not extremely computer savvy, and this is something I struggle with a great deal." So we're experts from the journalism and computer security communities. We went about this work by conducting in-depth interviews with 15 full-time journalists at news media organizations in the US and France. And in doing this, we wanted to focus on kind of the typical workflows to sort of understand what the general journalistic process was, maybe where there were gaps in that weren't being addressed by existing computer security tools. We didn't ask journalists directly about their threat models because that's really not a common term in journalism. So instead, we designed a set of questions about their risks and the consequences of those risks to kind of elicit the threat models there. And we did this as a qualitative data analysis, so conducted the interviews, had two independent coders go through the results in some cases, and we have tables of all of these results in the paper, you know, had some quantitative data about, you know, have these people used a particular tool or how many have used a particular tool, but also qualitative thing for themes about what their security concerns are, their general practices, some of the ad hoc techniques they use to secure their information. So just a few more details about the participants. The organizations really ranged. We had large multinational media organizations that operate in dozens of countries. We had really small kind of subject area focused organizations. And we also intentionally wanted to survey journalists who covered a range of beats, right? So not just the people who have perhaps the highest sensitivity information, but also people who are kind of just doing sort of regular reporting. So we did have some people who were covering government, for example. You know, we also had others who were doing sort of lifestyle and city issues. Even within this, we did find some pretty interesting anecdotes come out. For example, we did have one participant who reported that his home had been broken into and only his laptop was stolen. Another reported in working in doing having telephone communications with colleagues and sources overseas that technical glitches would often come up when they started talking about sensitive information, so clicks on the line or calls being dropped, and others actually reported being physically surveilled, as in that they were aware that they were being followed and their sources were being followed. So we structured this in terms of kind of general practices, security concerns, defensive strategies, and also maybe some computer security needs that that were as yet unidentified, right? Things that haven't already kind of been reported or identified up to this point. So in terms of general practices, we found that participants used a wide range of communication methods, so email, SMS, sometimes even social media, telephone. But in general, their tendency was to lean towards the preference of the source. We heard repeatedly that, you know, the main thing was you don't want to raise any barriers to communication with a source. So as one of our participants noted, you know, there's also the idea that maybe the source understands better than you do what their threat model is. And so, you know, we're going to go along with what the source feels comfortable with. Also, another important finding was that long-term sources are by far the dominant case when doing daily journalism. So, of course, we're all familiar with, you know, Edward Snowden and kind of big document dead drops. The reality is that this is a very, very small portion of how day-to-day journalism, even investigative journalism, accountability journalism really happens. And so, you know, that also raises a sort of a new set of security issues, and how do you kind of maintain, you know, protect the identity of a source, perhaps over a long-term digital communication. Audio recording and note-taking, digital note-taking, were the primary forms of interview documentation. We had a lot of people report using their phones to record interviews. Digital note-taking, sometimes done on the hard drive, sometimes done through third-party services. And that was also a really common theme. There was a lot of use of third-party cloud services to kind of sync information across devices, et cetera, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later. But very few of our respondents, articulated active security concerns about using third-party services in terms of the security of their information. Of the concerns that they did have, the primary concern, if information were to be exposed, was the effect that it would have on a source. And that effect could range from, you know, everything in the most extreme cases to a source being jailed or suffering physical harm, but, you know, just down to sort of plain old embarrassment. You know, that there was a lot of information that they have, much of which often doesn't make it into a published story, and that, you know, is retained, but you know, were it to be exposed, would be highly embarrassing to the source. And aside from the sort of personal feelings about having damaged someone else's life, was the problem of loss of credibility. The idea that if you we call it burning a source, right? If you burn a source, other people won't talk to you. Right? You'll become known as somebody who does that, and it's going to hurt your ability to do your job. It's going to hurt the reputation of your organization, and so that's a really big problem. Government identification of sources was also something that came up as kind of a background anxiety, as well as disciplinary actions that both the journalists might face within their organization for having failed to protect their information adequately, but also disciplinary actions, again, that the source might suffer, such as, you know, losing their job, you know, losing standing within their community, et cetera, et cetera. Some additional concerns that were a little bit more of a surprise were the loss of competitive advantage. This was, again, something that was voiced repeatedly. And that was, again, partly due to the idea that if you lose credibility, you know, with a source, that source is going to take their information somewhere else, right? And your competitor is going to get the story that you thought you had a lock on. But additionally, that if you're just kind of generally sloppy with your information, a competitor might discover what you're working on, right, and beat you to publication. And, you know, that's a case where for an organization as well as for an individual losing credit, you know, you could have a case where you spent weeks, months, sometimes years on a story, and you essentially lose the advantage of that because someone else beats you to the punch. And there's also potential financial consequences. So we did have some respondents sort of talk about having potentially embarrassing information about a major advertiser, and that if that were known, then that might influence the business relationship that the organization had with that advertiser. In terms of strategies that we found journalists employing, the vast majority of them were non-technical. Meeting with sources in person was a very, very common practice, but it was rarely articulated as a security strategy. For the most part, it was because they said, we get better stories this way. You get better stories when you talk to people face-to-face. Possibly has a security property, although we'll see later that not a complete security property. But other things like using code names in note-taking, for example. So, not writing down someone's true name, maybe only describing them with, salient details that they feel are only sort of interpretable to themselves. In an extreme case, using kind of intermediaries and preset protocols to arrange meetings and make contact. Authentication, which is actually also a really big thing that came up. So in this case, being contacted by somebody from a sort of unrecognized, digital identity, and the journalist saying, okay, well, if you really are who you say you are, then post this line to your public Twitter account at this time, and using that as a form of ad hoc authentication. Looking at the technical strategies they used, the most common by far was encrypted chat and some encrypted email. But importantly, this tended to apply to communications within a team or organization, right? So, maybe in talking to each other throughout the day, this is what journalists used, but it was much less common in communication with sources. Some file encryption as well, so, full disk encryption, device encryption. Things that didn't come up a lot were things like Tor, VPN, other secure messaging apps. We have, again, all of the details of these in the paper. So obviously we're interested in why journalists aren't using computer security tools, despite the fact that they have these needs and there are good tools out there. But we also sort of identified some of the main themes around why they did use security tools. And for the most part, it had to do with coming into direct contact with people who explained how to use them or asked them to use them. So very often it was because a source required it. So this person said, I won't talk to you unless you can do it over encrypted chat or encrypted email, or they had some kind of explicit digital security training that familiarized them with these tools. So some of them were internal, some of them were external, but basically someone had said to this person directly, you should be doing this and here's how. Where participants did make efforts to protect information, there was a sort of general awareness of like, oh, I should be doing this, and I know I should be doing this, and maybe I try to do this, a couple of things here and there. But as I alluded to earlier, these were often incomplete, right? So they might try to protect information in one context, but leave it vulnerable in another. So, going to meet a source in person, but taking their mobile device along, or even sort of trying to protect their communications with that person, but then doing a phone, using their phone to record the interview, which may or may not be synced to like iCloud or something like that. So even though the tools are robust, it's very often difficult. It's clear that journalists have a hard time kind of putting them together, patching them together in a way that really effectively protects them against all of the risks that they face. So in terms of the obstacles, again, a really common theme that came up was the digital divide as a very significant barrier to better communication security because, again, journalists are often going with what the source is comfortable with, what the source prefers. So as this participant noted, most of the sensitive sources I've worked with are also people who probably aren't very tech savvy. I don't know what a secure, non-intimidatingly techie way would be to communicate with them. Some of them don't even necessarily have email addresses. Another big issue was the absence of clear authoritative indicators about the protections offered by particular tools. So as I'm sure many of you are aware, there are lots and lots of new services, chat services, apps, all of this that have come out in the last couple of years in particular saying, this is secure, this is private, this is protected. And journalists just really don't have the time or the expertise to figure out which ones are actually worth using. And even of the ones that might be considered quality, really understanding the nuances of what they do and don't protect, right? And so how to actually operationalize their use in a way that successfully protects their information in the way that they need. Another thing was lack of institutional support. for obvious security reasons, a lot of reporters don't have admin rights on their work machines, right? That's a sensible thing to do. At the same time, they also don't necessarily, they often don't have, secure communications tools installed on those machines for them. And even if they can get permission to install it, they don't, a lot of folks don't have somebody, or at least somebody whose job it is to help them learn to use those things successfully, to practice using, making sure that they're configured correctly, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a real lack of resources at the institutional level as well. So again, why don't journalists use more tactical security tools? I think there's a lot of talk about usability, and while that does remain an issue, the truth is actually that journalists use terrible, terrible unusable software all the time, and they use it perfectly well. But that there's a big issue of how these things fit into the journalistic process or sometimes impede the journalistic process. So for example, document drops, might be great for a source like Snowden, but they're really not great for the more long-term source, the more common situation of long-term sources that that don't initially provide sensitive information. So this is a really important point, I think, which is that you never really know when a source is going to turn sensitive. Most sensitive sources are the result of long-term relationships that have been cultivated over time, which means that you might be having a communication with somebody and all of a sudden they say something that proves in retrospect even to be sensitive, right? It's by that time it's too late to switch communication channels. But that's very much how that kind of revealing of information tends to happen. The other thing is that in the vast majority of cases on a daily basis, journalists depend for authentication, for verification, on knowing their source's real identity. Yes, of course, it's possible to authenticate information even if you don't know a person's real identity, but it takes a much larger investment of time and effort to do that, and it's simply not practical to do that for every single story, every single day. Just a point of clarification, as one of our participants said here, if I don't know who they are and I can't check their background, I'm not going to use the information they give me, right? 9 times out of 10, it's not going to be worth it to do that extra legwork. And just a point of clarification about terminology here, if you ever hear journalists talk about anonymous sourcing, what they mean is I did not publish their name. It does not mean they don't know who that person is. Okay? Anonymous sourcing in journalism just means I didn't print it or put it online, right? But that reporter definitely knows who that person is. Their editor probably knows who that person is. So just to sort of facilitate the conversation there. And that confirmation and verification is really at the heart of what journalists do every day. So there's kind of a quip that my colleague uses, which is, the rule of journalism is if your mother tells you she loves you, confirm it, right? So you can't ever afford to take someone at their word, which means that this process of finding out whether or not they have the information they say they do, et cetera, whether or not they're for real is really important. So thinking about future tool design and some of the work that we see as could be informed by what we found here is to think about the barriers that are raised to people who are less expert or lower income by existing computer security tools, right? A lot of people are working with feature phones, they're working with SMS, they don't have exclusive control over a computer. So what are the opportunities for making a secure communications tool that work for people who are existing in those circumstances? Because those are a lot of the people that journalists are working with. And beyond usability, also thinking about stability and reliability. Journalistic organizations are businesses, even if many of them are not very profitable ones. Uptime, accessibility, consistency is important for them, which means that they have the same concerns as other businesses when adopting software, which means that even if the software is free, it's obviously not free to implement, right? It's not free to deploy, to train, to maintain. And very often, they don't necessarily have the connections or the service connections to have someone who is going to be able to patch, support, et cetera, that software, right? So without that, it's very difficult for organizations to adopt these things. Some of the things that we sort of identified as existing unmet needs that hadn't already been clear before, as sort of obvious risks, was knowledge management. So it came up many times, this issue of journalists, when they report on stories, they collect a lot of information from different places across different media. It's going to be web clippings, notes, emails, audio files, all of these things, and that storing, syncing, searching, tagging these materials were just a general challenge of doing their work. And so a lot of the ad hoc solutions that we saw to dealing with this are where security vulnerabilities were introduced. So that's where we saw a lot of third party, a lot of cloud software come in, was trying to address these issues. Not so much a computer security thing, but audio transcription was also just kind of a big, somebody said that's a nut to crack. But highlighted here by one of our respondents was, someone who had worked in the legal field for a while, as a lawyer, let's say you have a massive case, you have a document dump that has 15,000 documents. There are programs to help you consolidate and put them into a secure database. I don't know of anything like that for journalism. So this is a really massive opportunity to not only remove a whole slew of vulnerabilities that journalists are creating when they do this work, but also to make sure that the system that does fill that gap is one that has strong security properties. Secure first contact and managing the tension between anonymity and authentication came up more than once. Another respondent noting that the first contact is never very rarely anonymous or protected. It's very difficult to have that secure. And that's often because, especially in the Western context in journalism, more often than not, it is journalists who are contacting sources first, right? So again, the major case is you're covering a story, you're probably, your first call or first contact is gonna be with an existing source on that topic, and then you're gonna fan out from there. But most of it is not people coming to you. And so in that sense, it's a very source-dependent problem. Other things, effective metadata protection. So again, knowing that, especially with long-term sources, we don't have widely adopted ways of communicating that protect metadata. So, even if you do a really good job for a long time, that one time it fails, it kind of all falls apart. Also deeper exploration of the journalistic process and the needs of sources. So most of the folks that we spoke with were not dealing with a lot of video and photo, for example, right? And obviously those needs, the type of media they're dealing with changes the needs that they have in terms of security. It's something very different to talk about encrypting things when you've got hours and hours of video footage to deal with. For example, you can't exactly use a pseudonym when you have somebody's face in the material. And then finally, understanding the role of journalistic organizations and how some changes within that might be able to help inform that. So our goal with this, as we said, was really to kind of try to bring together these two communities and highlight some ways that we might be able to make progress on this front for both of us. So that's all, and I'd love to take some questions.
Great talk, Susan. Thanks very much. I wanted to go a little bit into this anonymity question. I understand the difference between what a journalist
means. We never really
mean
anonymous.
Yeah. So there's a concept that's been evolving of being able to prove things about yourself without revealing your identity. Proving that I'm over the age of 21 and therefore eligible to buy alcohol, proving that I do not have a felony, I've never been convicted of a felony and can buy a firearm, whatever, those sorts of things. Would those sorts of technologies be useful to a journalist in considering a source to be able to have proof that this person is in this role without knowing who that person is? Or is that culturally so foreign to a journalist that they would never even consider a technology like that?
No, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think, definitely, but it's hard for me to think about what the technical ways of doing that might be. I mean, if you think about just the simple fact of, like, somebody having a, like, at whatever email address, right? Like, that's a sort of simple way of, like, if I successfully communicate with you there, unless you're super sophisticated, probably, you know, you're there. So, I think actually, in fact, at this stage, a lot of journalists would welcome that opportunity, right? If I could know that this person, you know, this aspect of their credentials is, you know, provable without having to know who they are, I think that would be very welcome.
Because the technology does exist today. It's not in widespread use, but it does exist.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's just a question of making sure, you know, as we saw, like making sure that maps to the characteristics that are important to journalists to verify, right?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Hi. I was wondering about forward secrecy and kind of ephemeral tools. Is that on the radar of journalists at all? Because there's kind of a big divide between tools of the ephemeral chat tools, kind of iMessage, TextSecure, and then PGP. Mm-hmm. It seems like you spend a lot of time saying journalists are worried about making sure that they keep a record of everything and organize it. So do they think about forward secrecy at all? Is that, maybe they don't know the term, but do they think in that general idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that they think in forward secrecy is, you know, if somebody finds out after the fact I was talking to this person, they're going to get in trouble, right? So they're not thinking of it as forward secrecy. Definitely, like, chat tools, I mean, have been the thing that the folks that we talk to and that I know have had the most success in using, but a lot of that has to do with kind of the lower overhead and the lower advanced work that has to do with it, right? You know, if you look at something like, like CryptoCat, right? It's a browser plugin. Like, most people can do that. They can probably do it without admin rights. It's pretty simple to be like, and now go to the chat room with this name, you know, as opposed to explaining a whole authentication flow, or like sign up processes are a barrier, you know. And there's something else that I didn't mention, which is like part of this is also, there's kind of two cases when you're dealing with sensitive information. And one of them is that the source doesn't always know that what they're sharing is sensitive. And so this idea of switching channels is also this kind of the concern of spooking a source, right? And there's kind of like, whoa, wait, what? So there is that notion, but yeah, it's not something that, having records is important, but I mean, I don't know anybody who wouldn't be just taking notes on it at the same time if it was ephemeral, right? A lot of people record telephone conversations, but they might just as well be taking notes, so.
Thanks.
Very interesting talk. One of the things that I found surprising is just how, in some sense, almost self-serving some of the answers that the journalists gave in terms of securing the source. They say, you know, we don't want to spook the source, we don't want them to create any barriers, even if, you know, the source perhaps might be at risk. Do you think there are ethical issues that might come up with how journalists should protect sources?
I mean, absolutely. Like, I think it is an ethical issue. And, you know, some of the prior work that I had done on this was exactly before that reason. I think the problem is that there's a tension between, you know, if we restricted ourselves to covering only sensitive stories that involve people who also had the savvy and the resources, right? I mean, we're not just talking about, we're not just talking about sort of intellectual resources here. We're often talking about financial resources. Do you own a computer? Do you have exclusive access to a computer? Then we'd be missing a lot of the most important accountability journalism, you know, and sort of coverage of the most important populations, right? So many of our most vulnerable populations who ostensibly need to be covered, are the ones who don't have access to these tools and these resources. And, you know, and frankly, like, journalistic organizations themselves are strapped, right? You know, you can't necessarily, you know, you can't always fly to Hong Kong to meet the source. You may not even be able to drive upstate to meet the source. So there's definitely a tension there, and there are ethical implications. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, for most journalists, it's about doing your job. And everyone has concern about unduly exposing people, but at the same time, you know, it's either, at some point, it's either that or you stop doing your work.
Don't you think that it's actually, like, the common illiteracy of journalists is actually a failure of journalists themselves trying to publish actually research? So, if you think of it, encrypted chats, there is pretty much only one article in the internet provided by EFF that compares like encryption features in chats. Like, nobody, mm-hmm. like Washington Post would never publish a geeky article about which tools, you know, you would use to protect yourself. So illiteracy is a common consequence of this, don't you think?
I mean, yeah, there's certainly a literacy. I mean, I think the only thing I would say is that my experience is also that the computer security community has been kind of illiterate about the journalistic process, too. So,
fair enough.
But, no, I mean, and actually there are organizations. I mean, ProPublica actually did a really great comparison chart of, you know, various tools. But, I mean, listen, this is exactly why we're here, is to kind of open up this dialogue because, you know, we feel that there's interest on both sides and... yeah, very much looking forward to trying to facilitate that. So, thank you.
Okay, let's thank the speaker one more time.